Thank you, JD. This has been a great job. Glad to be able to be here this morning with all of you. Glad to get rained on this morning. That's great. Put a little water in Thames Ford and in Normandy, and maybe we'll all have some to drink this summer. That'll be good. As far away as Columbia is, we're pretty much completely dependent on Normandy. And so we're very interested in raining over here as well as over there. I've been to several meetings in the community over there about our water needs, and it always hinges on Normandy. Normandy, of course, as you well know, a fairly small watershed. It's got to rain in the right places. Columbia gets its water from the Duck River, and that water comes from Normandy. In fact, they told us this past summer we would have run out of water had it not been for Normandy. The Duck River would have gone dry, or relatively dry, and on our stretch of it, had they not just allowed Normandy to draw down. But obviously, there's a limit to how long you can do that. And I know the level went. I don't need that, but that'll bother me if it were to be laying there. But anyway, glad to get some water. We're glad to be able to be here with you today and to share in this service with you. And I do appreciate JD leading us. And he ended up leading a song that if I could have talked to him ahead of time and asked for a song to lead, he picked one that I would like for us to sing. And I'll, that will become apparent here in just a little bit. When Moses was talking to the children of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, which is sort of some parting speeches that he made to them, one of the things he said to them at the beginning of that is that you shall fear the Lord your God, or reverence the Lord your God. The Bible has a lot to say about God being holy and our response to His holiness, our reverence and humility in the presence of His majesty. The word holy means special, or set apart, or sacred, or separate, those kinds of ideas. And I'm going to want us to look today at a number of Bible passages, some of which I may go through faster than you'll be able to turn to them, but I'm going to read a number of passages, and I want us to think this morning together about the holiness of God. The first passage I want to read is from Exodus chapter 19. This is when Moses is on Mount Sinai, and he's going to receive the law from God. But just the description of what that scene was like. In Exodus chapter 19, beginning at verse 16, says, "So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there was thunder and lightning flashes and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. And they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was all in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder." That must have been a rather impressive sight, to say the least. In the book of Daniel, Daniel describes a scene which he saw in Daniel 7, verse 9 and 10, said, "I kept looking until the thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him." In the book of Revelation, in some of the opening words of that book, in chapter 4 of the book of Revelation, and actually I want to read the whole chapter. It's only 11 verses. But as John describes that scene, he says, "And after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard, like the sound of a trumpet speaking with me, said, 'Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after these things.' Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. And he who was sitting was like a jasper stone, and a sardis in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, like an emerald in appearance. And around the throne were 24 thrones. And upon the thrones I saw the 24 elders sitting, clothed in white garments with golden crowns on their heads. And from the throne proceeded flashes of lightning and sounds of peals of thunder. And there were seven lamps of fire burning before the Lord, which were the seven spirits of God. And before their throne there was, as it were, a sea of glass like crystal. And in the center and around the throne, four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. And the first creature was like a lion, and the second creature like a calf. And the third creature had a face like a man, and the fourth creature was like an eagle. And the four living creatures, each of them had six wings, full of eyes around and within. And day and night they do not cease to say, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and who is to come." And when the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to Him who sits on the throne, to Him who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders will fall down before Him who sits on the throne and will worship Him who lives forever and will cast their crowns before His throne, saying, "Worthy art Thou, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power. For Thou didst create all things, and because of Thy will they existed and were created." I read these descriptions just to give us some sense of the Bible's attempt to describe for us the majesty and glory and holiness of God before whom we serve. In Exodus chapter 20, we have the Ten Commandments. And four of those Ten Commandments have to do with the holiness of God and our response to them. We'll look at that a little more in a few minutes. God's holiness is important to us for a number of reasons. One is the very fact that we live in the presence of God. And the presence of God is holy. In Genesis chapter 28, Jacob had a vision of God in a dream. And in that vision we read God say, "And behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you." Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." Now it's interesting. What would Jacob's reaction be when he discovered he was in the presence of God? Jacob was afraid. And he said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this place is the gate of heaven." Because he felt he'd been in the presence of God. We're familiar with Moses' encounter with God on Mount Sinai through a burning bush. And of course, you remember that God said, "Do not come here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." In Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah had a vision of God, and it's interesting his reaction to that vision. Where Isaiah said in the year, chapter 6 of Isaiah, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of His robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood before Him and above Him, and each having six wings. With two He covered His face, with two He covered His feet, and with two He flew. And one called out to the other and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts,' and the whole earth was full of His glory. And the fountains of the thresholds trembled at the voice of Him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. And then I said, 'Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.'" We sang a song a while ago about holy ground, that we're standing on holy ground. Not because there's a bush burning, but for the same reason. Because God is here. And wherever God is holy. We live in the presence of God. During the days of the children of Israel, they, of course, worshipped in a tabernacle. It was a tent, a big tent with a sort of a curtained fence around it to keep people from approaching it too closely. And you remember the tent was divided into two parts, what was called the holy place and the most holy place. And of course, no one could go in the most holy place except the high priest. And he could only go once a year, because in the most holy place was a box, about the size of a cedar chest, except it was a very special box. The box was covered in gold, and the box had two angels on top of it, and then an empty space between the two angels. And the empty space between the two angels represented the literal presence of God. That's where God is. He's between the two angels in this empty space where you don't see anything. That's where God is. And it was such a, it represented such a holiness that no one could see it. No one could go there, but God was there. It was interesting. I used to wonder, of course, this was all a portable arrangement. You know, they would from time to time take the tent down and move all of this. And so I thought, didn't that sort of spoil the effect that nobody ever saw the ark, nobody went there? What happens when they take the tent down and pick the thing up and move it? Didn't everybody see it then? Well, it turns out, no, they didn't. Because when you read, it's very detailed descriptions given in the book, the books of Numbers, and Leviticus and Numbers, about how they did all of this when they did it. Really more detail than we really want, to tell the truth, for the most part. So we very seldom read all the very detailed descriptions of all this. But it's interesting, when the tent was all set up, and the ark was in the most holy place, when they got ready to break camp, and they're going to move all of this, the first thing that happened was that Aaron and his sons would take down the veil. There was a curtain that separated the holy place from the most holy place. They would take down that curtain with their backs to the most holy place. And then they, holding that curtain, would back up and lay that curtain over the ark so that they even didn't see it as they began disassembling the tabernacle. So that was the first thing that happened. And then it was covered in several layers of fabric and animal skins, so that by the time anybody saw it, it was just sort of this big lump, this big covered something that would have had no shape or detail with all the layers it was covered with. So even when they moved it, nobody actually saw it, other than just know, well, there it is, but you couldn't actually see it. Why? Because it was holy. Because it represented the actual presence of God. And God was too holy for anyone to see. You know, we don't worship in temples. We worship in church buildings. And sometimes we make a real point of saying, this building's not special. The building's not the church. The people are the church. And that's true and important. But there is something special about a place where people worship, where people come together to worship the holiness of God. And maybe sometimes we oversell the idea that the place isn't special. It's amazing that both in their day, when God was represented by an empty space, to our day, God is invisible to us. We cannot literally see Him. And He is so holy that He must remain invisible to us. That's pointed out several times in the Bible, that people couldn't see God and live. His holiness would overwhelm us. He is here, but we don't see Him. You know, can we understand how God could be so impressive, His glory so majestic, that if we were to see it, we would die? It would just overcome our physical bodies if we could see it. You know, I've been privileged to see a lot of pretty stuff and go to a lot of impressive places and even meet a few important people. But I've never felt my life was endangered by that. You know, I stood at the edge of the Grand Canyon, and it's just, you really can't put that into words. But I didn't really feel like my life was in danger because I was seeing it. I just kind of just felt at a loss for words. It's hard for us to imagine that God's majesty, His holiness is so great that if we were to actually see it, we would die. But even God's name is holy. And that's kind of an interesting thought. We know that. We know there are lots of Bible passages that talk about that. You know, names can be special. Names certainly can be meaningful. Names can be significant. You know, there's some great stories in the literature about names and how important names are. And the story of Romeo and Juliet. A lot of the drama in that story hinges from the fact that one was a Montague and one was a Capulet. And the Montagues and Capulets just didn't mix. Their families didn't mix. And Shakespeare raised questions like, would a rose by any other name smell as sweet? Does it matter what you call it? Well, yeah, it really sort of does matter what you call it. Names are important. But the Bible has a lot to say about God's name. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, Moses said, fear or reverence, not only God, but fear or reverence His name, His honored and awesome name, the Lord your God. There are a lot of passages in the Psalms about God's name. Let me just read a few to you. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. O magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt His name together. Sing the glory of His name. Make His praise glorious. May His name endure forever. May His name increase as long as the sun shines. Glory and awesome is holy and awesome is His name. Let them praise Thy great and awesome name, for it is holy. You know, we read those passages, we've heard passages like that so much that the significance of that's almost lost on us. Unless we were to try to do that to someone else, or to think about that, you know, everybody's got a name, I think everybody's got one. And we don't think really a whole lot about that, and we don't make a big deal about that. We just use names as identifiers, you know, and to ourselves as part of our identity too. But suppose I'll pick on Ward. Suppose I would say, Ward, what an amazing name. I just love that name. Now we might say that to someone. So we hear someone's name, we say, what a pretty name. Or I like your name. But suppose I just went on and on about that. Ward, isn't that the greatest name ever? Ward, let's put up a big sign to Ward. Let's put up a big sign with Ward's name on it. And if I went on about that too much, Ward and others would start thinking, okay, thank you. That's enough. Because this starts seeming a little strange if we made too big a deal about somebody's name. But that's what the Bible does about God's name. It talks to us about not just worshiping God, but worshiping His name and about honoring His name. And it goes on and on about that in a way that's almost odd. It would be if we were to do that about anyone else. And it is interesting that when God sort of boiled down everything He wanted the Israelites to know into 10 statements, you know, just kind of summarized everything and boiled it all down. If you could just put it into 10 statements, what would those 10 statements be? And one of those statements, when God boiled everything down into 10 things, one of them was, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes His name in vain. Oh, it's just kind of amazing that God, when He boiled everything down to 10 statements, one of them was, be really careful when you say My name. Only speak My name in reverence. The Israelites took that so seriously that they did kind of an interesting thing. There were several names for God, just like in English we have several different names to represent God. There was one name they commonly used. It was El, E-L. And that was a kind of a common, a frequently used name for God. And that found its way into other names, like Samuel meant asked by God. Remember, Samuel's mother asked for a child, and when the child came, she named him. I asked God for him. That was his name, Samuel. The passage we read a moment ago about Jacob feeling like when he saw this vision of God that he was in the house of God, and so he named the place. He gave the place a name where that happened, Bethel, house of God. But God had another name that was unique, and it was Yahweh. And this was the name. When it talks about these passages I read about ascribe to the Lord, glory due His name, that's the name Yahweh. And the Israelites took God's commandment so seriously that they not speak that name in any way but reverence, that they eventually just didn't say it at all, lest they violate that. They just didn't say the name Yahweh. They wouldn't say it out loud. And to make sure they wouldn't say it, eventually they dropped the vowels out of its spelling and just left the consonants to make it unpronounceable. You couldn't pronounce it, because it's kind of funny if you think of your own name and think about what it would be if you took the vowels out of it. I realized I would be left with DVD, but that's a little hard to say as a word. In fact, you know, we can't pronounce words that don't have vowels in them. And so they did that. They made God's name unpronounceable by spelling it without the vowels, because the name was so sacred and holy that you just didn't speak it out loud. It's a little frightening sometimes that we this is kind of an aside, but that we don't hold God's name in that kind of reverence, and it's probably a little scary. You know, when people use God's name as an exclamation, oh God, something happens, oh God, or say that, you know, it's kind of frightening to think when God boiled everything down to just 10 things, that was one of them He said not to do. You know, don't speak my name unless you're talking about me or to me. Don't say my name. My name is only to be spoken in reverence. So God must be treated in reverence, treated as holy. I must remember that I do stand in the presence of God. I'm in the most holy place. I am where God is. And again, the reverence and awe that must be held in. The Bible tells us about some folks who didn't do that very well. In Leviticus chapter 10, we have the opening ceremony of the tabernacle. This was when they first put the tabernacle into use. They set it up for the first time. They're having the first set of worship services and offering sacrifices at the tabernacle for the first time. And those sacrifices are being offered by Aaron and his sons. And here, the first round through doing this, Aaron's two sons are struck dead by God. And we read about that in Leviticus chapter 10, because they offered the wrong fire. They didn't get the fire, apparently, from the right place to offer the sacrifice. And God struck them. Wouldn't that be kind of a bummer? You're having kind of your open house, your first day at your church building, you know, and the preacher drops dead during the service. You know, that would sort of throw a damper on the covered dish dinner that was to follow, I think, or whatever. But Nadab and Abihu dropped dead during the service, the opening day. And you can imagine that Aaron's their father. Aaron the high priest is their father. Imagine his feelings, like, here we're trying to lead in worship and God strikes them dead, his own sons. But Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy. And before all this people, I will be honored." And then it adds a commentary, "And Aaron said nothing." He realized Moses was right, that God will be treated as holy. Moses himself had a similar problem many years later. You remember that near the end of the wilderness wandering, they're in the last year of the 40-year wandering before they're going to finally enter the promised land, and they had perpetual water problems. It's tough to take 2 to 3 million people on an extended camping trip in the desert. And so they had constant water problems. And so in one of these instances where they're having significant water problems, you remember that God told Moses to speak to a rock and he would cause water to come out. And so Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And Moses said to them, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" And then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Isn't it interesting, when we tell that story, what we usually say went wrong was they hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. And while that is a description of what happened, that was a symptom of the problem, not the actual problem. God didn't say you're not going to get to go into the promised land because you hit the rock. He never says anything like that. And when this is discussed later with Moses, it doesn't say anything about Moses hitting the rock being the reason why he didn't get to go. What it says, what God said is, "You did not treat me as holy. That's why you don't get to go." Now, hitting the rock was a part of that. But God zeroed in on the bigger problem, that you did not treat me as holy. And so you didn't get to go. There's a later story. Remember the story of a man named Uzzah, who reached out and steadied the ark when he thought the ark was going to fall off a cart, and God struck him dead. Okay? Let's listen to this. So why was Uzzah struck dead? Because he reached out and touched the cart, touched the ark, which represented the presence of God. Okay? But listen to what it actually says is the reason why God struck Uzzah dead. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, it says, they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, and Uzzah reached out toward the ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. He did reach out and touch the ark, but the reason that was a problem was that it's God. You don't reach out and grab hold of God. That box represented the presence of God. You don't reach out and touch that. It was irreverent to do that. It was not treating God as holy. We could look at other instances, but I think we see the idea that God demands of His people that they be holy and that they treat Him as holy. But then also, and I just said this ahead of myself, He demands that we be holy. Well, that's a whole other, you know, maybe I can grasp the concept of God being holy, but how in the world could I be holy? In 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter said, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves in all your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. You know, kind of adds a whole new dimension to it, that if I'm God's child, if He's holy, then I am to be holy also. Christ died to make us holy. We on our own cannot be holy. Certainly can't be holy in the sense that God is. But if we think again about what the word holy meant, to be sanctified, to be set apart, to be special, those kinds of things, then God does want me to do those things. In Ephesians chapter 5, Paul said, Christ also died for the church and gave Himself up for her that He might sanctify her. It's another form of that same word, that He might make the church holy. Christ died to make the church holy. You know, when Christ died, the veil tore. The same veil I was talking about that Aaron and his sons would take down and walk backwards. Not the very same one, but hundreds of years later, there was a veil like that in the temple too, and eventually there was a permanent structure for the worship of God. Had a similar veil in it, a curtain that separated the holy place from the most holy place. But at the death of Christ, that curtain just tore open all by itself. Well, not all by itself, but God opened that curtain. And that veil had separated people from the presence of God. You're on this side, God's on that side. And of course, it was significantly symbolic. That is, that veil opened. It represented the fact that now we all are in the presence of God. We're not one place and God's someplace else. Now we enter the presence of God. It's not that God is less holy. It's that He expects us to be more holy. And we're made holy through the death of Christ. Paul talks at great length in Romans and other places about how God has made us righteous, made us holy through the death of Christ. And certainly no coincidence that that curtain tore open at the moment of Christ's death. We are to be saints. The word saint means holy ones. In Romans chapter 12, verse 1, in a familiar passage, he talks about the word to present ourselves to God as a living and holy sacrifice. How are we to do that? Well, Romans 3, verse 2 talks about the words of God as being holy and that we are entrusted with them. If God is holy, then whatever He says is holy. And I participate in the holiness of God through doing what He says. It certainly was significant that Moses hit the rock instead of speaking to it. But in that way, and through his attitude and what he said, he was disrespecting God. It was significant that Uzzah reached out and touched the ark when God had said, don't touch it. Because in doing that, it was irreverent. It didn't acknowledge the holiness of God. And so the things that we do certainly are significant in our attempt to be holy before God. Way back in the book of Leviticus, again, after that incident with Nadab and Abihu, God said, "You shall consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. And you shall keep my statutes and practice them. I am the Lord who sanctifies or makes you holy." There's interconnection between being holy and following the words of God. In Colossians chapter 3, we get a good look at what does it mean really to be holy. What does holy living look like? And so in Colossians chapter 3, I want to read several verses from that chapter. And listen to this connection that's made between holiness and some specific things that we're to do. Okay, so Colossians chapter 3, beginning in verse 12. "And so, as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved." Okay, so who are we talking to? We're talking to people who are chosen by God and people who are holy. Okay, what does that look like? "Put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another, forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. And beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. And let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in one body. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ richly dwell in you, with all wisdom, teaching and admonishing one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with thankfulness in your hearts. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through Him to God the Father." That's a description of holiness, a description of holy Christian living. The time will come when we will see God in His full glory. We will literally stand in the presence of God. In Revelation chapter 20, I want to read in the following, 20 and 21, I want to read several descriptions. And these are familiar descriptions, but just think about standing in the middle of this, of us being in the middle of this in the presence of God. John said, "And I saw a great white throne, and Him who sat upon it, from whose presence the earth and heaven fled away, and there was no place for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written there, according to their deeds. And the sea gave up its dead, which were in it. And death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And they were judged, every one according to his deeds. And death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and first earth passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and He shall dwell among them, and they shall be His people, and He and God Himself shall be among them. And He shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain, for the first things have passed away.' And He who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.'" Later in that chapter, "And I saw no temple there, for God, the Lord God, the Almighty, the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and the Lamb is its light. And the nations shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. And in the daytime, for there is no night there, the gates will never be closed. And they shall bring glory and honor of the nations into it, and nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, but only those names who are written in the Lamb's book of life. And I saw a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and the Lamb, in the middle of the street. And on either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit in every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall no longer be any curse. And the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it. and his bondservant shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads. And there shall no longer be any night. They shall have no need of the light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever. The day will come when we can literally be in the physical presence of God, when we will see His face, worship His name forever. But that's for those, and will be those, who have recognized His holiness all along. And God encourages us, He pleads with us, to recognize that He is holy, and that we are in His presence. As surely as Moses was when he stood at a burning bush, as surely as Aaron was once a year when he walked into the most holy place, we are in the presence of God. And so that calls upon us to live as godly and holy people, as Paul described in Colossians. This morning, if you're not a Christian, we would encourage you to embark on a life recognizing the holiness of God and a life of holiness yourself. Or if you've wandered away from that kind of life, we would encourage you to come back while we stand together and sing.